not any real need for an introduction when Dr. Robert Lustig writes a book called The Hacking of the American Mind. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Before you wrote The Hacking of the American Mind, you wrote Fat Chance, and you said that brain science was needed to put that book together, and certainly the same for this book. Did a certain research or something click for you when you were putting that other book together that made you decide, oh, now we have to do the hacking book?
Yes, well, exactly right. I've known about the tenet of the current book, The Hacking of the American Mind, for about 30 years. I was a postdoctoral fellow in neuroscience at the Rockefeller University, you know, cutting up rat brains and throwing sex hormones in the mix and seeing what happens. So I'd known about the dopamine and serotonin connection for a long time. But I didn't quite understand what role it had in human behavior. As I was researching Fat Chance, which was about diet and physical health, I realized there was a wealth of information, new information, about the role of diet and behavioral and mental health. And so I was sort of poised and ready to write that. But then in 2014, I was giving psychiatry grand rounds at a medical school here in the United States, and the head of the clinic for the substance abuse recovery program for that medical school was giving me a tour of the facilities, and she herself was a recovered heroin addict. And I asked her, you know, just offhand, what being clean meant to her. And she said something that was very jarring. And she said, "When I was shooting up, I was happy. What my new life has given me is pleasure." And I looked at her. I didn't say anything, but I said, "Well, that's exactly wrong. That's turned around." And so I asked a couple of psychiatry friends here at UCSF. "Oh, yeah, we see this all the time, and it's part of why they're addicts, is they don't know the difference." And I said, "You know, this is the dopamine serotonin connection," and really that was the stimulus, the immediate stimulus to write this book, because if this woman didn't get it, how many other people don't get it? And if the whole country doesn't get it, maybe that's why we're in the state we're in.
Yes, and honestly, I was surprised that would even be a question. And I felt like it wasn't even naive to think that people know the difference between pleasure and happiness. But obviously, maybe that is not the case. And it is true that we are not really putting these pieces together. And your book, you certainly describe so much of the science in a way that, you know, the average American can't certainly understand it. So it's quite a success in that realm. Dopamine trumps serotonin, pleasure trumps happiness. Enter the hackers. This is your premise for the book. And where do you want to start with that? I mean, I want to ask you right off the bat, why did the FDA get away with squashing serotonin research for 40 years?
Oh, well, the answer to that is easy. It was called Woodstock. the counterculture revolution scared the bejesus out of the military. They were very worried about the baby boomer generation, the generation that was protesting in the streets about Vietnam. There was a huge social upheaval, really, a minor revolution, and some people actually did lose their lives during that time, like Kent State, etc. The armed forces were very worried about LSD, and they were very worried about Timothy Leary, who became the proponent of LSD, as he told people to tune in, turn on, and drop out. And they made, shall we say, a societal case that these serotonin agonists, of which LSD, magic mushrooms, etc., were examples of, that these were dangerous to American society, and so the Drug Enforcement Act of 1970 banned all serotonin agonists, basically Schedule 1, not to be used, not to be studied. They did the same with marijuana and a few other medicines as well.
Yes. And
so, we basically suffered a dearth of information on exactly what was going on for a long time. And it did allow this notion of pleasure as happiness, which the industry, various industries started selling, to really take hold.
Looking back at it all, I feel like how silly to squash the research, because by doing the serotonin research...
Not the first time research has been squashed by government.
Oh, no. Believe me, we are well aware of that. But by squashing the serotonin research, what they've done is they've had to ultimately have squashed a part of the dopamine research and all of the research that has gotten us to where we are today, where we're probably in the realms of the most unhappy society, most toxic, most unhappy, etc.
And most addicted. Remember back in the 1980s, Nancy Reagan's Just Say No. I mean, we had a huge drug war going on, between the United States and Colombia and, Bolivia, et cetera, with cocaine trafficking and heroin trafficking. So that pales in comparison to the opioid crisis that occurs now. That's being led by American pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly. Yeah, let's say no to drugs, but let's go to the pharmaceuticals and say no to them. Do you want to start by giving a little lineup of the dopamine and serotonin, or would it be easier
let's start with the premise of the book.
Okay.
The premise of the book is that pleasure and happiness are two different things, and that you can't derive happiness until you understand the difference, which is exactly what's going on in America today. So let's define the seven differences. Pleasure is short-lived. Happiness is long-lived. Pleasure is visceral. You feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal. You feel it above the neck. Pleasure is taking. Happiness is giving. Pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. The extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors, so substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors such as gambling, internet, video games, social media, porn, all in the extreme lead to addiction. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And then finally, number seven, pleasure is dopamine, happiness is serotonin. So two different areas of the brain, two different sets of receptors, two different mechanisms of action, two different regulatory pathways. So you say to me, well, they both feel good, like why should I care? And indeed, that's what has happened to America, is why should I care? Well, actually, it matters a lot. It matters quite a bit. And here's why it matters. And it has to do with the science. Turns out dopamine is excitatory. It is a neurotransmitter that excites the next neuron. Now, neurons like to be excited. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But they like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Neurons are very fragile. They go quickly. Okay, and we're learning that very clearly in terms of the Alzheimer's and dementia pandemic that we also have. Neurons are very fragile structures. And it turns out that chronic overstimulation of a neuron leads to neuronal cell death. Well, chronic dopamine release due to chronic attainment of motivation and pleasure ultimately lead to neuronal dropout, which leads to addiction. So the postsynaptic neuron, the neuron receiving the dopamine information, has a fail-safe. It has a plan B. It has a self-defense mechanism. What it does is it downregulates the receptor so that it can be stimulated less well. So in human terms, you get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush because there are fewer receptors, and then the receptors go down and a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit until finally a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons start to die, that's called addiction. Serotonin, however, turns out to be an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It doesn't downregulate its own receptor because it doesn't have to, because excess serotonin won't kill the next neuron. So you can't overdose on too much happiness. But it turns out there's one thing that downregulates serotonin, dopamine. So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. And there's one thing that downregulates the serotonin receptor, cortisol. So the more stress you feel, the less transduction of the happiness signal you can even muster up. So dopamine and cortisol basically destroy your ability to perceive happiness. And we are living in an all dopamine, all cortisol, 24/7, all the time world that has been constructed for us by industry.
So what is the reverse hack? I mean, you've been on this trail of dopamine, serotonin, cortisol for over 30 years, as you mentioned. Where is the rest of the medical community? Are there a lot of professionals on your track at the moment? It seems like I can maybe speak for some of the alternative practitioners who are working with this. But, you know, would you say most of the doctors are part of the whole neuromarketing hacking scenario going on?
Well, I will. Let's start by saying that doctors learn how to treat diseases, not prevent them. And I think this is a huge problem in American medicine today, is that doctors understand how drugs work, but they don't understand how food works. They don't understand how life works because they're not taught. They're not taught how to do it. And it's not in any protocols, and it's not in any consensus documents, and it's not in any guidelines. And I know that because I helped write some of them. So doctors are not where to find the information today, sadly. Now, there are specific types of physicians who deal with addiction, and there are specific types of physicians who deal with depression, and they don't meet. They're different, and they don't necessarily understand that one is impacting the other. They don't understand how environment ultimately leads to either addiction or depression. Their job is to, alleviate the symptomatology rather than deal with the cause, because the cause is much, more upstream and much more societal rather than individual, personal. So this is a problem for physicians to be able to do. In the meantime, you have industries that have moved into both of these spaces, the addiction industry and the happiness industry, if you will. And they are not necessarily selling you things that will actually improve your life. They're capitalizing on your misery in order to sell more junk, telling you that this will make you happy, and in fact it actually saps your happiness instead. And you don't realize that that's baked in as well. So we have a medical profession who doesn't understand, and we have an industry complex that is actually taking advantage of the issue. Very few people have put the serotonin dopamine connection together at one time.
I guess it's because I feel so knowledgeable now after reading your book that I just feel like, how can that be? I've been doing alternative medicine for a long time now, so I get it, but it's nothing less than criminal, and obviously the hacking of the American mind is a criminal act, and the fact that it's done purposely.
It's not criminal. It's legal. It's actually quite legal, and it's been made legal by the Supreme Court because commercial speech is free speech, and companies are allowed to say anything they want without fear of repercussion. And this was actually handed down by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision in 1980 that is called Central Hudson versus Public Energy Commission. And it basically says that corporations are allowed to say anything they want, that they can lie. You have to catch them in their lie and sue them for the lie. They are not required to tell the truth on the front end. So, who's going to do that? And who's got the money to go up against a big corporation?
Right.
And it's not like government can do anything about it. In fact, government's hands are tied. So You know, corporations can say what they like, and corporations do what they like as well, and it's all in the name of free speech. So corporations are now people, as you know. Citizens United from 2010 gave the employees of corporations double rights because they gave them the rights of corporations, that they're an employee of the corporation, and they gave them the rights of individuals. So you can't even sue them. So there's nobody to sue and there's nobody to take down. So we are basically at the whim and the behest of big corporations, and they are allowed to market, and I put that word in quotes, their products any way they seem fit. So my question to you is, what's the difference between marketing and propaganda? Marketing is using information to espouse your point of view. Propaganda is using disinformation to espouse your point of view. The difference is the truth. So when companies tell the truth, they're marketing. When they don't tell the truth, it's propaganda. Problem is, how are you supposed to know the difference?
Most companies are not really doing marketing.
Indeed, they are not. And they are pushing their products at whatever buttons they can push. The problem is, we are very subject to propaganda. I mean, you can look at Nazi Germany and you can look at the White House. The bottom line is, propaganda sells. Alternative facts, fake news, these are all propaganda ploys. And the problem is that a very sizable proportion of the American public has bought into this phenomenon, and it is making people across the country supremely unhappy, addicted, depressed, fat, stupid, broke, and ultimately this is an existential crisis to our country.
Yes, and you give away the punchline in your introduction to The Hacking of the American Mind, and that is...
My publisher said I had to.
That is that it's not about personal responsibility, but only you can pull yourself up. I mean, when there's, you know, when a company or a government gets too big for its britches, it falls apart, and then what comes out of it? Community. And I feel like we have to help ourselves, and we have to start looking other places. And I think the word is out. I mean, your book is in the forefront, of course, but the word is out that we have to learn how to pull ourselves up. And in your book, you come up with very insightful help and why certain things work on so many levels. And
I appreciate that.
As you said, you're not putting a Band-Aid over something.
The cause works. Question is, how do you up your serotonin? How do you tamp down dopamine so that you can actually feel happiness and contentment, which is, you know, what everyone says they want, but then they, you know, go off and, you know, gamble or, you know, drink themselves silly. You know, the point is that all of the things that up your serotonin are clinically proven to work, evidence-based, will work, or your money back. And none of them cost anything, so don't expect anything. Because they're all things your mother told you, you just didn't know why.
Right, or everyone should be a Buddhist now, because that would...
Well, right. Well, I'm not a Buddhist, okay?
I'm not either.
On the other hand, Buddhism does at least espouse the same basic precepts that are, you know, the things that up your serotonin. So they are in the what I call the four C's, and they're all acts. They're all things you have to do or have to perform. None of them are passive. They're all active, the four C's. First one, connect. Now, connect does not mean Facebook. Connect means direct, eye-to-eye, face-to-face, interpersonal interaction in someone's presence. And the reason is, for the exact reason that corporations are now doing what is known as neuromarketing. So when you have a set of neurons in the back of your head called mirror neurons, and these neurons are reading the facial expressions of the people you are talking to on the fly. And you are actually adopting some of the emotions that they themselves are feeling. And this is a process that has a name. It's called empathy. And it is basically linked to increasing serotonin. Now, unfortunately, companies, corporations have have learned that this is important. After all, every society on the planet have the same exact facial expressions for the same emotions, irrespective of language, irrespective of where that culture developed or grew up. It's baked into our DNA. Corporations have learned the code and are actually using your facial expressions to change the marketing to you on the fly so that you will continue to buy their product. So they have hacked your brain in the same way that other people read you. They're reading you and changing the message. This is not good. Facebook is not connection. It's connectivity, but it's not connection. You cannot have a connection with Anonymous, and emojis do not convey empathy. In fact, Facebook has been shown to contribute to depression. In a time lag analysis, no matter where you started on the depression scale, after 2 weeks of Facebook, you are more depressed. And there's, you know, fMRI and PET scanning data of the brain to document that. The second C, contribute. And that does not mean to your IRA. Contribution is outside of yourself, to others, to your family, your friends, society at large. People always ask, well, can't work count as contribution? And the answer is yes, it can, with two provisos. The first is you can see how your work helps others, and number two, your boss can see it too. If that's the case, you actually can derive that contribution, that happiness from your work. But a lot of people don't have that opportunity for whatever reasons. And so they still need to find their ways to contribute. And, of course, there's volunteerism. There's, you know, managing your kids, you know, softball team or Boy Scouts. There's altruism of various sorts, you know, visiting sick people in the hospital. There's philanthropy, pay someone else to do it for you. You know, there are many ways to contribute, but it can't be for your own personal benefit. It can't be because you're getting the Boy Scout badges. Number three, cope. And COPE has three parts to it, sleep, mindfulness, and exercise. And all of those are designed to tamp down cortisol. So by keeping cortisol down, you keep the serotonin receptors up so you can transduce that serotonin signal. So sleep deprivation is a huge sapper of happiness. And, of course, all of us are sleep deprived nowadays.
Yes, and if I can just break in here one moment to let our audience know that your book also has a sense of humor where, in big letters, you say, sleep your way to the top. And you just described why and how.
Indeed. Well, Arianna Huffington gave me that quote. Indeed. So it turns out sleep deprivation is a killer of contentment by increasing cortisol. And, of course, we're all sleep deprived. Children who sleep with their cell phones charging in their room get 28 minutes less sleep per night than children whose cell phones charge outside the room. I mean, from the blue light, from the temptation. It's a problem. Number two, mindfulness. Now, we all value this new term called multitasking. And it turns out that only 2.5% of the population can actually multitask. The rest of us are doing serial unitasking with smoke and mirrors. And it turns out that every time you switch tasks, you're bumping your cortisol. So you are actually stressing yourself out to lower your serotonin receptors by trying to impress your boss with just how many balls you can keep up in the air. And, you know, that's not a good thing. And, you know, some bosses are starting to realize that. And so mindfulness is a way of sort of focusing. So mindfulness meditation is basically exercising the portion of your brain called the prefrontal cortex, which controls that reward system and brings it to heal, to tames it, if you will. So that's extremely important and something that's been lost. And then finally, exercise. Turns out exercise is better than serotonin and reuptake inhibitor antidepressants at alleviating depression. Problem is, of course, getting somebody who's depressed to exercise. Not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
And then the last C, cook. So there are three items in food that matter. One is tryptophan, which is the precursor to serotonin. It's the rarest amino acid.
You know,
hardest to come by.
I was curious why you think the tryptophan is very rare in food.
It's very rare in food.
Yes, why?
It is the single rarest amino acid. Of the 20 amino acids, it is an essential amino acid, is the precursor of serotonin, and there isn't that much in food. The food that has the highest tryptophan content is eggs, and then come poultry and fish after that. And after that, pretty much none. It's pretty darn low. So people who are vegan, you know, are probably not getting the serotonin, the tryptophan they need to be able to produce serotonin. So that's one thing that's pretty important. Another thing that's important is omega-3 fatty acids.
Yes.
Turns out those are anti-inflammatory. When you deprive animals of omega-3s, they end up with this inflammatory haze around their serotonin nerve terminals, which appears to interfere with serotonin neurotransmission. And then when you give the omega-3s back, that inflammation seems to go away. And of course, omega-3s are pretty rare in our diet as well, as we've switched from marine oils to seed oils. And then finally, fructose being the sweet molecule in sugar, that directly depletes serotonin while raising your dopamine. And so the more sugar they put in stuff, the more unhappy you will end up being, although you will think you're very happy because you're deriving pleasure. It's the addiction. It's the thing that keeps you coming back for more. It's great for the food industry's bottom line, but it's really, really bad for both your health and your mental well-being.
Yes, and I just wanted to mention the phrase metabolic syndrome, because I don't think that's a term that's very widely known. And if people just learned a little bit about it, which they can do in your book, or I'm sure by Googling, they will learn so much quickly.
The thing about metabolic syndrome that is not really appreciated is a cluster of diseases. That cluster of diseases like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, heart disease, cancer, dementia, they tend to track with obesity. And so people think obesity is the cause of those diseases. That is not true. Obesity is just another marker for
yes.
those diseases. It's yeah. just another one of the diseases, but it's not the cause of the other diseases. Normal weight people get metabolic syndrome too. Not at the same rate as the obese, that's true, but they get it too. And it turns out there are more thin-sick people in the country than there are fat-sick people. Mm-hmm. And they're chewing up all the health care dollars so that by the year 2029, there will be no health care, Obamacare, Trump care, or any other care. The problem is you don't know you're being hacked, okay? I mean, you can't recognize the hack unless you understand the method of the hack. And you can't figure out how to extricate yourself from a ditch unless you know how you drove into it. You know, the fact of the matter is that this is going on all the time, 24/7, 365 in this country. And most people just call it modern life. And if that is true, it is modern life, and that's exactly what the problem is. So if you want to sort of reclaim your life, if you want to bring it out from the deep, dark underbelly of consumer culture, you have to understand what the hack is. And the hack is the confusion and conflation of these two terms, pleasure and happiness. And you need to know the difference.
And thank you so much for taking that on.
Hey, it's my job. It's what I do.
Yes.
My job is to fix the problem. And unfortunately, this is a problem people ultimately have to fix themselves. But you can't fix a problem if you don't know the cause.
My hope is, and obviously I envision a medical community and a general population with a broader and better understanding of this line of inquiry and thinking.
Well, if it means anything, I just got off the phone an hour ago with a principal in UNESCO. You know, the United Nations
yes.
Educational Science and Cultural Organization, and they are aware of this issue. It is starting to fly above the radar, but it's going to be a long, long slog.
Dr. Robert Lustig, The Hacking of the American Mind. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is on iTunes at Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.